This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. Neil Conan is away. The so-called troop surge in Iraq is supposed to make a noticeable difference by September. That's what the White House said when it unveiled its new strategy for Iraq back in January. Now the new commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus, says the much-awaited progress report will be more of a snapshot than a definitive list of accomplishments. Lieutenant General Raymond Odierno, who manages the day-to-day operations of the war, says he can't predict when the extra 30,000 troops that surged in this spring will be pulled back out of Iraq, or when base U.S. troop levels could be drawn down. These developments beg the question once again, what is the benchmark for success in Iraq? Are the goalposts shifting again? Washington Post correspondent Thomas Ricks returned to Iraq in late May, and he has his own snapshot of the expectations and morale in Iraq. Later, can echinacea really help you beat a cold? Do cell phones cause brain cancer? We'll find out the answer to those and other questions when science writer Anahad O'Connor joins us. And you can email your questions for him now, talk@npr.org. Is breakfast really the most important meal of the day? But first, changing goals in Iraq. If you have questions for Tom Ricks about his trip to Iraq or questions about our goals in Iraq, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us from our studios at the Washington Post is Thomas Ricks, military reporter for the Washington Post and author of Fiasco. Welcome, Mr. Ricks.
Thank you.
You traveled to Iraq at the end of May. Tell us what you saw there and what you've seen change since your last trip to Iraq.
I think the biggest single thing that struck me was on every previous trip, I think I'd been on seven previous trips to Iraq, every time I'd been there, things had been notably worse than on the previous trip. People would always say, it can't get any worse than this, and then it did. First thing that struck me was, it's not any better, but it's not any worse than it was, say, the last time I was there. The second thing that struck me, I mean, you know, but we're talking about degrees of hell, basically, you know. It hadn't descended from the ninth to the tenth circle. It was still in the ninth circle of hell. It's not a great improvement to be holding steady in hell. The second thing that struck me was I used to hate going into the Green Zone, which is the international zone in downtown Baghdad that's walled off and very tightly guarded, even though mortars come in. And it's the headquarters of the U.S. effort and of the Iraqi government. I used to hate going in there just because it was such a sea of nonsense to wade into. It was totally divorced and isolated from the realities of Iraq. I remember talking to some American officer 2 years ago who was briefing me on something. And at the end of the briefing, he said, by the way, what's it like out there? And I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm not allowed out of the Green Zone. He'd never been out. The people who are running the U.S. effort there now do get out. A lot of them spend more time outside the Green Zone than they spend in it. And also, I think they have a more realistic attitude. They recognize that the official optimism of the U.S. effort over the last several years was part of the problem, not part of the solution. And so I think they are trying to be more sober, more realistic in their assessment of the situation. And so I found I didn't get a headache every time I went in the Green Zone.
So you're saying the change in strategy that the Bush administration unveiled in January has led to a change in the way this war is being operated in the military?
Absolutely. I think the single biggest difference is not the troop increase, which is a relatively small number dribbled in over several months. It's not really classically what in military terms you'd call a surge. It's more a dribble. The real big difference, aside from the new cast of characters running it, which is significant, is the deployment of troops, the movement of troops off big isolated bases and out into small, vulnerable outposts across the capital. Last time I looked, I think it was about 70 such combat outposts or joint security stations. And that's a real significant difference in how the U.S. operates in Iraq.
Can any of this change be translated into something, some amorphous idea of success? The military is gathering data all the time that it calls metrics on whether or not things are quote-unquote working, but they're also seem to be telling reporters which data to look at and which not to look at. For example, not to look at, I think it was Lieutenant General Odierno who said not to look at the number of troop deaths, for example. What is the military gathering, and what should reporters be looking at for some measure of success?
Well, there's two different levels you want to look at. One is tactical, what's happening day-to-day on the streets of Baghdad. The other is strategic, what's the overarching situation? What is the trend and direction of Iraqi politics? Tactically, I think people would generally say that the troop surge has had a mixed record at best on the ground in Baghdad. We are taking larger risk with our troops by deploying them out into the city. We are taking more casualties. That said, in parts of the city, they do seem to be improving security somewhat. Not absolutely. It's a totally relative term. It's nothing like what you would call secure in any other city of the world. Anytime you hear machine gun fire or have mortars flying overhead, you're not going to feel secure.
Is the Pentagon...
But that said, though, the real problem is strategic. You've had some mixed tactical success, but you've had no indication of strategic movement, which is to say no signs of political movement in Iraq towards reconciliation or even simply accommodation between the various parties in this low-level civil war. And that's a really bad sign. This troop surge, this new plan, was announced 6 months ago, more than 6 months ago at this point, yet there's been no indication that Iraqis are going to solve their political differences. And every single officer who follows this in Iraq will tell you, ultimately, you've got to solve this politically. And so the indication is that this is not really going anywhere.
So what does the Pentagon, Thomas Rick, say is the goal here?
Well, I noticed your introduction talked about changing definitions of success in Iraq. That's not altogether bad. I think the beginning of wisdom is to recognize that Iraq is a tragedy for us and for the Iraqis at this point. It's not going to end well. The question is, can we mitigate the damage we've done? Can we somehow get out of Iraq more intelligently than we went into Iraq? And actually, when I say that, I'm quoting what an officer in Iraq said to me. That's part of, the new sobriety in the U.S. approach. So the changing definition of what we're trying to do there, I think, is actually a sign of wisdom. The bottom line that I'm hearing is, look, we'd like political accommodation, but now we need to begin to talk about what we would settle for. There's a new study that's put out by a new think tank, the Center CNAS. It's a Center for National New American Security. Mm-hmm. That was just released, I believe, today by a guy named James Miller, which says, look, our bottom line in Iraq should be the three no's: no safe haven for al-Qaeda, no regional civil war, and I think the third was, I can't remember what was the third, but no attacks or something. What was it? No genocide, mm-hmm. which is to say no genocide against Sunnis. That's a pretty minimalist agenda. It's certainly not what we went into Iraq to go after several years ago, and it's certainly not anything the Bush administration would recognize. But I think that may be about where we come out, which is, look, we're not going to really achieve what the Bush administration said it wanted to achieve at the outset, which is to turn Iraq into a beacon of democracy that would then transform the Middle East. That was a huge agenda. Instead, what this Miller report says is this is a bottom line of what we minimally might achieve there, and this is what we should aim for.
Tom Ricks, let's go to the phones quickly and get in a couple of questions specifically for you. This is Melissa in Charlotte, North Carolina. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to, first of all, say that I absolutely loved your book, Making the Core, from many years ago.
And thank you very much. Actually, it's interesting, partly because of the success of Fiasco, Making the Core is being reissued next month in a new edition with a new update.
Is that about the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I followed one platoon of Marines through boot camp and then through their first couple of years in the Marine Corps. And for this new edition of the book that comes out next month, I actually went back and talked to a lot of the Marines in the platoon and also to the drill instructors. And it really struck me. I had not expected this. What we ended up talking a lot about was Iraq. And so the new afterword to Making the Core, to a surprising degree, is about Iraq, because so many of the people who stayed in have done now one or two or three tours of duty in Iraq. Also, in a rather sad coincidence, the Marine battalion commander who oversaw the troops who killed a score or more of Iraqi civilians at Haditha, was one of the Marines I knew at Paris Island and wrote about in my book. It's Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Chassani.
Melissa, what's your question?
I was kind of framing that in context of, I know that you were, you know, so familiar with the Marine Corps, and it seems, I don't know if it's the province of Anbar that the Marines have been stationed in lately, or the operating methods of the Marines versus the operating methods of the Army. What do you attribute that to, part of the reason it seems we're seeing so many more Army casualties than Marine Corps casualties?
I don't really. I think it's more attributable to the politics of the places. The Marines were taking a lot of casualties in Anbar province over the last couple of years.
Yes.
You go back to November 04, the Battle of Second Fallujah. That was an awfully tough battle, and the Marines took a whole lot of casualties. Things have quieted down in Anbar, it seems, because a lot of the sheikhs there, the tribal leaders, have turned against al-Qaeda. Evidence of that is the attack yesterday in the Mansour Hotel in Baghdad, where a bunch of the sheikhs got blown up, the pro-American or at least anti-al-Qaeda sheikhs. The army casualties have gone up recently because of this redeployment of troops out of the bases into the combat outposts, which is a far more aggressive posture, in a way much more like the Marines have been out in Anbar province.
Tom Ricks is the military reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Major General Mike Davidson. He's retired. And we're talking about the changing goalposts for Iraq. More of your calls in a minute. Send us your email, too, at talk@npr.org. We're at 800-989-TALK. I'm Andrea Seabrook. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about the shifting goals in Iraq. My guests are Thomas Ricks, military reporter for The Washington Post and author of Fiasco and other books, and now Major General Mike Davidson. He's retired. He's the former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Gentlemen, let me start with this. In Sunday's paper, New York Times columnist Frank Rich quoted retired Army General William Odom saying, quote, "The end game will start when a senior senator from the president's party says no, just like Mr. Fulbright did to LBJ back in the day." Last night, listen to this. Senator Richard Lugar, a Republican from Indiana, on the Senate floor.
"Our struggles in Iraq have placed United States foreign policy on a defensive footing and drawn resources from other national security endeavors, including Afghanistan."
General Davidson, let me start with you. Does it sound like Mr. Fulbright, and does this spell endgame to you?
Well, to quote that famous American philosopher, Yogi Berra, it is deja vu all over again. Politics can undeclare a war, and I still hold the Congress accountable, and Andrea, you know a lot more about Congress than I do, for not declaring war. The president went to war preemptively on his own initiative, and I think what's happening on the ground is more or less unrelated to what's happening in the Capitol.
Thomas Ricks, what do you think of, how does Richard Lugar's statements last night on the Senate floor, how does that change the political landscape of this war?
Well, I think I'll follow General Davidson's lead and quote Yogi Berra, "It ain't over till it's over."
He's so quotable.
I think it may look like Fulbright, but may not walk or quack like Fulbright in this way. I think President Bush is basically going to stay in this war until the day he leaves office. I doubt that the Republicans, even if they bolt against the president's position, will join with the Democrats and pull the plug on this war. So you may have a lot of political sound and fury, but it's not clear how much it ultimately will signify. I think also Bush has basically played his cards, put his chips on the table, and made his decisions. He doesn't have a whole lot more decisions to make in Iraq. This is rapidly becoming the next president's war. We will be in Iraq when the next president comes into office. The question is, how long will the next president keep us there? And what will the mission be as he or she sees it?
But, gentlemen, let's think back just a few weeks ago, just really a couple of months ago, to when the Democrats tried to force a benchmarks and an end, a pullout, a withdrawal from Iraq. Of course, the president's veto was the only thing stopping that from going through. But doesn't a change in Lugar stance, I mean, he's one of the weightiest Republicans when it comes to foreign policy, doesn't that change the way this is debated, at least in the Congress? General?
I don't think so, Andrea. I think the Cooper Church Amendment was the legislation that actually ended funding for the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to get to a Cooper Church level of political commitment by members of Congress and the Senate to pull the plug. And I don't see that happening before the presidential election.
Why not?
This is a learning enemy that we're fighting in Iraq, and they will change their tactics to meet our political needs. So we're not calling the shots entirely ourselves. And I think our Congress will respond to public opinion in the United States, and I think public opinion will respond to what's happening on the ground in Iraq.
Tom,
Andrea, I agree with the general for two reasons he didn't lay out. First and foremost, I think, is the Democratic Party does not want to get tagged with the people who did Iraq like they did Vietnam.
Hmm.
That the Democratic Party carried that burden for decades, and they don't want to renew it for another three decades. The second problem is that Vietnam, in retrospect, was at the periphery of American interest. Iraq is not. Getting out of Iraq is going to be a lot harder than getting out of Vietnam.
Then let me ask you all this. There is a lot of talk in both parties, and not just increasingly. It's now comes up every time any politician talks about the Iraq war, and that is the two words, exit strategy. What is the talk right now, General Davidson, about an exit strategy? What does it mean? What might it look like?
There is a lot of contingency planning. There is no focused strategy that I'm aware of being put on paper, because presidents and secretaries of defense get to set war policy. Generals and admirals and soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines implement that policy. So you can't operate it from the ground up. You can't go bottom up on a strategic decision like this. So I'm not aware of any senior military officer who thinks they have, to include our new war czar, who thinks that they have the authority to make a decision like that.
And Tom Ricks, how are people talking about this in the military on the ground in Iraq?
Somewhat differently than the way General Davidson just laid it out, for this reason. While they know they're not there to make strategy, they also see certain imperatives. Foremost is that troop levels are going to come down next year. That's not an opinion. That's a 99% fact.
And that's politics, right?
Well, no, it's actually not. It's simply that there, as my favorite strategist over at the Pentagon says, we're out of Schlitz. There are no more troops available. And so sometime between now and March of next year, troop levels must start coming down unless you do something nobody wants to do, which is make troops start doing 18-month-long tours of duty. That is the only way to keep troop levels at their current level of between 150,000 and 160,000 in Iraq.
Aside from the unspeakable word of draft.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, first of all, nobody in the military wants a draft. The last thing they want is a bunch of surly draftees who don't want to be there. But the second thing is, even if you started a draft right now, it wouldn't give you enough the troops to keep troop levels up just 8 months from now or 10 months from now. If everything goes much better than expected, if we start seeing political accommodation and things start going well in Iraq, starting about March of next year, you're going to start seeing troop levels go down. On the other hand, if everything continues as it is, which is pretty poor, or worsens, and you start getting things like Iraqi units turning on American troops, which is one of the nightmares, then starting in March of next year, troop levels are going to start to come down.
Let's go to the phones. Nathan in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, glad to be here, hello, gentlemen. The question that I had for you all was, there's this overall strategy that gets spelled out of bring democracy, save the world. What exactly, though, are the objectives? They've shifted so much. I guess, where does it get to a point where we have a solid objective, it's achieved to a certain percentage rate, and then the situation reaches critical mass, it becomes self-sustaining? Obviously, if the troops surge was put in place, there must have been some objective to meet, especially if in 10 months we're not going to be able to sustain those levels. So I guess, where do we go from there?
Good question, Nathan. It's exactly what we wanted to do this hour. General Davidson was asking you to, what's the goal and how are we getting there?
We have a phrase for that in the military, the truth changes. And the truth may not actually change, but the circumstances on what makes something true or untrue change a lot. So it's a very fluid situation. The caller is entirely correct. There have been half a dozen different goals, strategies, objectives set out. Each one changes. The next three will change as well.
Tom Riggs?
To follow the general's lead, there's also an acronym I've heard occasionally in the military, an abbreviation actually, NGH, not going to happen. The purpose of the surge was to operate tactically in such a way as to create a breathing space for Iraqi political movement. That was the strategic goal that the tactical operations were supposed to lead to. That is not happening. And so the question is, okay, then what else do we do out there? And that's why you're seeing a lot of talk on the ground in Baghdad about, if there's not political movement, what else do we do out here? And what do you do with the next president's force, which is what they're talking about now?
So I'm not clear on what exactly the goal is with what's happening now. Are we just biding our time? Is the U.S. biding its time until it comes up with another goal, General Davidson?
Let me try and explain that very briefly. The strategic center of gravity is a political allegiance of the Iraqi people toward a form of government or a government, and their willingness and their commitment to make sacrifices to support that government. For them to make that kind of commitment, they have to see a better life ahead with that government. That's the strategy. That's what will determine who wins, who loses, outcome, good, bad, or indifferent. Now, militarily, we are trying to provide a security environment where the Iraqi government can begin to function effectively. We've got a lot of great young Americans, some not so young, trying very hard to make this war work. It's a deeply flawed policy because at the end of the day, I don't think any number of American soldiers can secure Iraq. I think only Iraqis can secure Iraq. So our strategy, I'm afraid, has us on a treadmill right now.
And Tom Riggs, let me ask you this. You've said a couple of things that have sort of piqued my interest. One thing you said was it's holding steady in hell. You said that one of the nightmares scenarios you listed. So let me ask you, If the strategy or the goal right now is predicated on things going well, what would it look like if things got worse?
Well, it could easily get worse. You could have isolated U.S. outposts cut off and wiped out. That's one of the big worries. The other is the Shiites have been relatively quiet. Another nightmare scenario that's present constantly is the possibility of Muqtada Sadr and his Mahdi army, which is he's a radical Shiite cleric, probably the most powerful Shiite and certainly the biggest winner in post-Saddam Iraq. If he calls his troops out again, then you basically have a two-front war that the U.S. military is confronting in Iraq. So there's lots of different ways it can go bad. We've experienced some of them already. There's really only one way it can go better, and that's what the general just laid out, which is Iraqis saying, actually, we want this to be different. We want some sort of political reconciliation.
And is there any indication that it really is moving towards that one better scenario and not towards one of the many worse scenarios?
At the provincial level, at the low level, yeah, when you see these tribal leaders cutting deals, and we really don't know the details of those deals, but cutting deals that somehow get them out of the anti-American camp and at least into a neutral camp and sometimes even supportive camp. That's clearly been a problem for the enemy. It's one reason they attacked the sheikhs in the hotel yesterday and killed four of them. But we're not seeing any movement at the national level. Now, what they'll tell you in Baghdad is, you know, give it time. If we could see more and more of this provincial movement, ultimately that might lead to movement at the national level. The other thing that's going to happen is you're going to see one or more Iraqi leaders die. One is very sick with cancer in the way Iraqi politics have gone. Another is likely to get blown up. I don't know which one over the next year. And so the players will change, and that will change the political possibilities at the national level as well.
Okay, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And thank you very much for your call, Nathan. Let's go back to the phones. And David in Kiefer, Oklahoma. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm really glad to hear people talking about definitions. What is the definition of a good exit strategy? What is the definition of success in Iraq? And a word I've heard the administration use with regards to the way votes were going to turn out in Congress, as well as the way things are turning out in Iraq, is the word surrender. And to me, surrender has always meant throwing your arms up, giving up your weapons and such. Isn't a surrender kind of an inflammatory term when it's used in that context? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, David. General Davidson?
David, we don't surrender. And finding a solution for Iraq that does not involve the only army the United States has in Iraq, certainly I would not consider that surrender, nor I suspect would the Iraqis.
Tom Ricks, let me ask you, the idea of maintaining a small combat force in Iraq seems to bubble up every single time someone talks about, you know, members of Congress or an official talks about the end strategy for Iraq. What's the argument for that?
Well, first of all, I think we should ban the phrase the end strategy. We're a long way from the end in Iraq. I'm a fan of Shakespeare's tragedies. His tragedies have five acts, and I'm pretty persuaded we're only in Act 3. But Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are still alive and operating on the stage. So there's a long way to go here. The reason people talk about a residual combat force is basically this. They are betting that for all the rhetoric, the Iraqi Shiites, who really are the big winners in post-Saddam Iraq, don't really want us to leave Iraq. And that includes Muqtadir al-Sadr, the radical cleric. So the thinking is you probably want to leave a guarantor force to guarantee the security of the Iraqi government, to deter coup attempts, to deter foreign intervention, and also to prevent the Sunnis from thinking that they can launch a big new offensive against the Shiites as soon as we leave, and also to keep the Shiites from thinking they can commit genocide against the Sunnis. So you have a combat force. I've heard one reinforced mechanized infantry division, which would total about 20,000 troops. You obviously need people to supply them, to help their communications and command and control, so headquarters, logistics. That gives you another 5,000. Then you probably want an advisory force of 5 to 10,000, and you'll have a special operations force of several thousand to focus on al-Qaeda in Iraq. So very quickly, you get to a residual force of about 40,000 to 50,000 troops. And that's what people on the ground in Baghdad are betting that the new president, Democrat or Republican, male or female, will likely say, okay, that's what we're going to have in Iraq for several years.
Well, forgive me for pushing you both gentlemen on politics again, but it seems as though there is really a dissonance between what experts like you two understand is the Pentagon way and must be the way forward in Iraq and what the American people want. Is there a void of political discourse here that correctly explains to American people that the U.S. will be there for some time, for better or for worse?
Perhaps. There was a good column in Tom's paper this morning on Nixon's reelection in 1972, and that the public would countenance a president who was making progress in a difficult war, in this case, Iraq. What people forget now is that Nixon started his withdrawal in 68 and was still withdrawing in 72. So I think a phased withdrawal buys someone in the White House of either party a lot of time and a lot of goodwill from the American public.
And Tom Ricks?
One thing I picked up on the ground in Baghdad last month was the strong feeling among a lot of officers that the political debate back here was indeed, as you say, a sterile one. The term I heard was stale in that it presents a false dilemma. all or nothing. Either stay in Iraq like you are now at about 150,000 troops or get out altogether. And one officer made the point that even if you began getting out now, it would take you 12 to 18 months to withdraw if that were your aim.
Tom Ricks is a military reporter for The Washington Post and author of Fiasco. Major General Mike Davidson is the former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Gentlemen, thank you very much.